Thank you for your attention. We wish to welcome you to the opening session of the 16th Annual Law and Religion Symposium. We are grateful tonight for your presence, for the presence of many honored guests and distinguished delegates. And we will now, I'm pleased to present to you the Dean of the J. Reuben Clark Law School, Dean James R. Rasband.
I'm delighted to have this opportunity to welcome you briefly to this opening session of the annual symposium of the International Center for Law and Religion Studies, and particularly to welcome you to the J. Reuben Clark Law School here at Brigham Young University, of which the center is an important part. I echo Gary Doxey's comments in expressing my gratitude to so many distinguished delegates and guests who are here tonight. And we hope you will feel welcome while you're here at the law school and while you're at the university. We are honored by your presence. This will be a marvelous symposium. I understand we have more than 70 delegates from more than 43 countries around the world. I won't read through all of those countries, but I'm sure that as you get to know each other tonight and in the next couple of days, you'll learn that this group spans the entire globe. And it's wonderful to have you with us. Apologize for the less than congenial weather, but to paraphrase an old carol, while the weather outside is frightful, the congeniality between this group should be delightful. I also want to just thank those who've made this conference a reality for the law school, particularly the International Center for Law and Religion Studies, Professor Cole Durham, who has led that center and really is the one who has made this possible over the years, but those who work with him there, others in the law school, our staff who work so faithfully, and a number of students to help make this happen. So I'm grateful to them. As I welcome you to law school, I thought I might just tell you just a little bit about the J. Reuben Clark Law School. We were founded in 1973, and we have approximately 450 students. It's about 150 students in each of the 3 years of classes. We also have a small LLM, or Masters of Laws program, with about 8 students each year. This year, those students come from Brazil, Mali, New Zealand, Australia, Mexico, and China. We have an outstanding group of students here. Approximately 77% of our 450 students speak a foreign language. About 100 of those students speak a second language, and many more speak 3 languages. By their entering credentials, our students are in the top 20 classes in the United States. You'll notice, however, that this week the halls will be quite quiet. Our students are away on what we describe as our placement break. They're out looking for jobs and doing interviews for a week. And so there won't be many here, although we have a number of students helping with the hosting. And I just want to express my gratitude to those students for sacrificing their time this week to help. Now, the J. Reuben Clark Law School is part of a much larger university. Brigham Young University has almost 33,000 students coming from all 50 states in the United States, as well as many, many foreign countries. The university offers bachelor's degrees in 186 different academic programs. It teaches 55 languages and has 158 study abroad programs in 58 different countries around the world. It admits about 5,400 new freshmen to the university each year, which is also a fairly remarkable group. This year, the class included 418 persons who enrolled who were valedictorians in their high school class. The average college exam entrance score for the BYU freshman class is in the 92nd percentile nationally. Now, the law school and the university both want to be great by accepted standards. But we also have a unique mission to spiritually strengthen our students. And at the law school, we're committed to teaching them the laws of men in the light of the laws of God. Now, it's religious liberty that allows us to do that here at this law school. And so you can imagine how important the topic of religious liberty is to us here. We're delighted to have you here tonight to contemplate the difficult and complex legal issues and conundrums that that surround the relationship between the state and religious institutions. And we're grateful to have such a distinguished group to help us think about those issues. So again, I welcome you to the law school, and I am pleased to have you here. I want to take just a minute to introduce to you my good friend and colleague, Dr. Sandra Rogers, who is the International Vice President of Brigham Young University, and she'll greet you on behalf of the university. Now, Dr. Rogers has responsibility here at the university for the David M. Kennedy Center for International Studies, our ambassadorial visits program, and the BYU student abroad programs. In addition, she oversees the university's division of continuing education. Dr. Rogers has broad experience in the international arena. She has studied and served and worked in countries such as the Philippines, Nigeria, Romania, and Jordan. As a nursing professor, she was asked to serve as a consultant for numerous international programs, including training and development projects funded by the United States Agency for International Development. Dr. Rogers also served as dean of BYU's College of Nursing for 6 years, where her research focused primarily on primary health care programs. She earned her doctoral degree from the University of California at San Francisco, specializing in international and cross-cultural nursing. She also holds degrees from the University of Arizona and from Brigham Young University. It's my pleasure now to have Dr. Rogers greet you on behalf of the university.
It's always a privilege to welcome each of you to Brigham Young University on behalf of President Cecil Samuelson, our faculty, our administration, our staff, and our students. The Law and Religion Symposium, hosted by the J. Reuben Clark Law School, is one of the signature events of our campus community. We hold such an event because of our heritage of concern and interest in religious liberty. As a people, we are committed to religious opportunity and religious freedom. And we're willing to defend it, and we're willing to discuss it. We are grateful to have each of you here. I was interested in the title of the symposium this year, Connecting Communities of Discourse, How the Judiciary, Academia, Government, and International Institutions Further the Work of Religious Freedom. I wanted to say first that probably only those in academia could have thought up such a long title. And maybe that's our contribution to the discourse. But without these four elements working together for the benefit of individuals who want to exercise their faith, it would be a sad circumstance for many of the citizens of our nations around the world. Without the dialogue, the research, the questioning, the protections, the interests provided by each of these four institutions, it would be difficult for people of faith to worship and to serve. And so we're grateful that each of you are here. You represent these four areas of discourse, and we are very pleased that you've taken time from your schedules and from your assignments to come and participate in the dialogue here in our symposium this week. I would also like to welcome those who will be speaking this evening. Anastasia Crickley, who is the chairperson of the European Union Fundamental Rights Agency, and Pius Nkonzo-Longa, the Chief Justice of the South Africa Constitutional Court. It is the credentials and the experience that you bring with you that makes the Law and Religion Symposium so successful and so important. And so again, on behalf of all of us here at BYU, we welcome you, we honor your work in religious freedom, we're grateful to have you with us, and we hope and are assured that you will have a very engaging dialogue during the symposium this week. Thank you.
We will now have a presentation of a Distinguished Service Award by W. Cole Durham, Jr., Professor of Law and Director of the International Center for Law and Religion Studies.
For the past several years, as we have... For the past several years, as we have held this conference, we have taken the occasion to give an award for distinguished service to someone who has made significant contributions to the work of our center and also more generally to the field of law and religion and religious liberty. This has been done at different times in different years, but this year we decided to give the award in this session because for the first time this session is being streamed live via the internet, and by doing it now, the recipient's family and friends, we hope, if all is working well, will be able to see the presentation of the award. This year's recipient is Judge J. Clifford Wallace, who doesn't know about this in advance, but he has been one of the great friends of our center. I think we've talked about this, and I think there are just three or four people who have been to all 16 of the various symposia that we have had. For those of you who don't know Judge Wallace, let me tell those of you who don't know him just a few things about his background. He's a graduate of the Berkeley Law School, where he graduated at the head of his class, subsequently practiced law for 15 years in San Diego, and then was appointed to serve as a federal district judge in San Diego, and shortly thereafter in 1972 was appointed to the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit. For those of you who are not familiar with our court system in the United States, the appellate level immediately below the Supreme Court is divided into 12 circuits. The Ninth Circuit is easily the largest of these, I think by miles. Judge Wallace became the chief judge of that circuit. He is now one of the senior judges of that circuit. But in addition to the massive judicial work that he has done, he has, since being appointed a federal judge, has traveled to over 60 countries working on improving judiciaries and contributing to judicial administration around the world, as well as work on constitutions, on human rights, and on freedom of religion or belief. Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, formerly of our Supreme Court, has described his service by saying, "He has made more trips than any other judge in the history of the United States. It's staggering." And I think she was not talking merely about taking junkets. I've been on a few of these things with him, and I know how hard he works and the level of the contribution he makes. While his work and engagement has been global, he's taken special interest in Asia, where he has worked on judicial issues in China, the Philippines, India, Pakistan, and probably most of the countries in Asia over time. An example of his many contributions is the creation of the Judicial Training Institute in Thailand, which now serves as a hub of judges in Laos, Cambodia, and Vietnam as well. U.S. Supreme Court Justice Anthony M. Kennedy, who has traveled with Judge Wallace, tells of riding with a Thai judge who pointed to the training center building and said simply, "Judge Wallace." Beyond all else that he has done, Judge Wallace is someone who knows how to move beyond roles and simply connect with people and make a difference as a person. Deborah Wright asked when we got the award whether we had made a mistake by not inscribing judge in front of his name. And I said, "I don't think so. He is someone who stands not merely because of titles, but because of the person he is." So maybe, Judge Wallace, if we could have you come up and accept this award.
Paul always does wonderful things. As you know, these conferences, he does the impossible, but he expects other people to do the impossible also. He asked me if I'd like to say a word or two. And I would. Two words I have in mind. Thank you. This is truly a wonderful thing that to have happen. I was completely unaware that it was going to take place, but because I know what it stands for, I'm humbled at accepting it. And I must say that one of the truly memorable things that I've done over the years is to work with Cole Durham in these wonderful symposia that have taken place here at Brigham Young University. It's been a high point of my professional work, and I'm sure you'll understand why if this is your first one after you've been here for the 2.5 days. I want to thank all of those who participated in letting me get through without a black ball to receive this. There are so many out there who know so much about me that that they could give good reasons why I shouldn't receive it, and I want to thank them for not saying anything about that, and thank those who did not know better and said nice things about me to believe, Cole, that I really should receive the award. Thank you very much, and I look forward to participating with you over the next 2 days.
It's now my distinct pleasure to be able to introduce our two keynote speakers for the opening of this session and of this symposium. We're highly honored to have them. I'm going to speak about both of them briefly and then turn the time over to them. At the end of Chief Justice Longa's remarks, we will adjourn the session. And we have in the foyer and beyond, we have a reception for all of the delegates and guests who are here. Our first keynote speaker will be Anastasia Crickley, who is an expert of great stature in the field of fundamental human rights. She is currently the chairperson of the European Union's Fundamental Rights Agency and is the Irish representative to that body. Anastasia Quickley's past positions include being the personal representative of the chair in office of the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe on combating racism, xenophobia, and discrimination, also focusing on intolerance and discrimination against Christians and members of other religions. She's active with a number of organizations. She is also an educator. She's the head of the Department of Applied Social Studies at National University of Ireland in Maynooth. I tried to condense as much as I could the honors and the positions and the activities in which she's engaged. I found it impossible, and rather than take away from her time to speak, I thought you'll have to witness her goodness through the things that she says. But you need to know that her awards and her honors are numerous, and we're so grateful to have her with us. Now, I had a moment to speak with Chief Justice Pius Konzo Langa of the South African Constitutional Court. And as we spoke, I said, is there anything special I ought to say about you? And he sort of challenged me to find something that he doesn't know about himself to be able to say about him. Well, I started to read through the near volumes of things that you could say about him, positive things, and I gave up. And finally concluded that, along with Anastasia Crickley, that we would be better served simply to hear from him. But you need to know something, a little bit about his background. He was born as the second of seven children to deeply devout parents, and by dint of hard work, he rose from humble beginnings in the townships, completing his high school education through private study, and then obtaining his law degrees, two of them, by distance learning. He had a distinguished career as a barrister and advocate, and practiced for many years until 1994, representing the downtrodden, the underrepresented, and among others, political prisoners in the fight against apartheid. And when the Constitutional Court of South Africa was established with the advent of post-apartheid constitutional and democratic institutions in 1994, President Nelson Mandela appointed Justice Lange, together with 10 others, as the first judges of that tribunal. Justice Lange later became the deputy president in 1997, and in 2001 assumed the position of deputy chief justice. In 2005, he became the country's head justice, or chief justice, of the Constitutional Court. He's had numerous activities, and there's a list that we could probably paper the walls with of his honors from many institutions, educational and otherwise. It is a distinct honor to have him with us, a person of great prestige outside the borders of South Africa. He has contributed to constitutional reforms and the struggle for justice and human rights in many countries in Africa and elsewhere. Without further ado, we'll turn time over to Anastasia Crickley.
Thank you very much, Gary. Sometimes I'm a little concerned when somebody starts to introduce me. You get a little worried because you never know what they're going to say. And it's not always clear in advance that it's going to be things you want to hear, but never mind. And thank you very much for saying all the things that I like to hear as well. But before I speak, and I want to speak to you perhaps for about 15 minutes, because I understand there might be some time for questions or exchange and dialogue afterwards as well, I want to thank you all for this unique opportunity to visit this university here. Thank you very much. And for the privilege to be able to share and to learn with you over the next couple of days. I would also, in particular this evening, though, like to take this unique chance to publicly thank Cole and all of his colleagues and the people who work with him for the support that they have given me in the international work that I've been concerned with, for the small contribution I've been able to make internationally in support of freedom of religion and belief. I would like to take this chance to acknowledge publicly also Cole's own contribution to work on religious freedom. And I think through that, I feel very, very much the way he has been able personally to enhance understanding and respect for religion and belief, and for his own religion and beliefs, not just in this country, but in very, very many parts of the world. And I'm very glad to be able to say that here in his home university, because I'm very conscious that very often those of us who work in many places, here, there, and yonder, we come home, we run in the door, and we run out again, and maybe we leave people wondering what we're doing when we're outside it. So can I just assure you that everything that I know about the work of Cole Durham and all the support I've had from him leads me to conclude that his contribution is a truly wonderful one, and one I'm very happy to have had some small association with. I attach great importance to connecting communities of discourse for a more just, tolerant, and equal world, for freedom, including religious freedom, is cherished. For me, this has been very much the way that I have tried to work as an activist in civil society, as a chair and a leader of various national and international organizations, and as an academic. It seems to me that at this time of great global challenges and uncertainties, such connections, which are ever more important, won't come about simply by wishing them into existence. And from that point of view alone, I very much welcome this opportunity over these few days to engage in what I hope and I know will be robust and engaging discussion about how they can be made possible. To connect communities of discourse, parity of esteem is required across divisions and disciplines, with deep-seated perceptions of our own uniqueness, whichever bit we happen to come from, and superiority. And we also need moves, I believe, towards integration of issues and dimensions that are seldom treated together. We need to get beyond the parallel lines and the railway tracks, which often divide those of us who are trying to systematically work in the same direction. Connectedness for me means not only just being aware of other issues and dimensions, but also taking them on board in discourse and in action. With regard to religious freedom, denial of discrimination and dismissal of associated hate crime, these demand not just legal absence of such things, but also respect. Respect, in turn, demands recognition of diversity, difference, and rights for the minorities and the groups, and for the men and the women who are different. Laws and regulations, both in your country and in mine, and in many countries globally, help in this way. But real respect and recognition, in my view, can only be realised if there is redistribution of power and resources. And our various global and national histories don't give us much to be proud of in that regard. Histories of colonization, domination, and exploitation challenge us continually. Religious freedom, then, I'm suggesting, demands respect, recognition, and essentially redistribution of power and resources, perhaps also within religions. And I make no apology for speaking as a woman in that regard. Connecting communities of discourse is an essential prerequisite in this process. And I'm sure we can make some progress in that regard in these coming days. As part of my modest contribution to this opening session, I would like now to point to some of the conclusions and comments that my own work in Ireland as chair of the National Consultative Committee on Racism and Interculturalism, and also as a member of the Irish Council of State more recently, and as part of a number of European Union, European and regional-wide institutions, has led me to. Before doing this, since these institutions and realities have shaped my thinking, let me contextualise my remarks by saying a little bit about Ireland, and forgive me if I'm boring you with that, and a little bit about the European Union and the Fundamental Rights Agency, which I chair. Now, Ireland, in case you didn't know, and maybe you don't, was colonised for 700 years by the British. We have lots of songs and we have lots of different ways of telling the story. And over in the last 200 years of that period of colonisation, the Irish diaspora are to be found in virtually every part of the world, and certainly every part of the United States of America. However, the exploitation that we experienced ourselves as part of a diaspora was no insurance against our capacity to discriminate against others. And I say that as one of the things I think we need to think of as we debate these things, that our own exploitation, marginalisation and oppression doesn't insulate us fully from repeating the process when given the opportunity. And I have to say with some sadness that as the so-called Celtic tiger took off in our country over the last decade, he or she has now run away entirely, though. We were not so good at looking at how to treat the people who came to contribute to the success of that tiger. Our 1937 Constitution gave a special place to the Catholic Church, as indeed many new countries' emerging democracies do to the religion they feel has been oppressed in the period before they got freedom. This position has been more or less removed now by a referendum of the people. And the removal of the Catholic Church from a special position in our Constitution has in no way diminished the power, influence, or credibility of the Church. Through the work that took place in the last decade on challenging racism on a more positive side as well, interculturalism, and through promoting integration, structured dialogue with churches and faith communities, including also non-confessional bodies, was established by our government in 2007. And this has been a very positive development, a development which I believe, in terms of bringing together different communities, has been able to contribute to the diversity that's part of Ireland now. But debate about the institutional role of religion in our society has not gone away. And in particular, some of you may be aware, because the reports have been also made here, due to the fact that a number of the people who are abused are now living in the USA, reports of abuse of young people in institutions run by religious over the period between the 1950s and the 1980s have done nothing to make that institutional role more positive. Again, when one looks to try to explain what happened, one cannot but look to the way in which our fledgling democracy at that time was dependent on a partnership with the Catholic Church in order to provide the social policy mechanisms and the social policy responses that were required to make living in Ireland possible. More recently, many of our partners in Europe have looked a little bit askance at the reintroduction of the offence of blasphemy into our legal system. A position that's seen as inconsistent with Ireland's own position on defamation of religion, and I'd have to admit to you that it probably, to many of us, looks as though it probably is. But the way in which the offence has been put, has been described, will in fact make it quite difficult for a case to be taken, and even more difficult for such a case to be proven. However, the very introduction of the offence, which, to be honest, was not done at the behest of the religious communities, all of whom stated that they did not require it, again, I think gives evidence of the intricacies that are involved when we try to pick our way towards a climate in which religious freedom is acknowledged and respected for all. To turn to the European Union then, on Friday, my own country voted to ratify the Lisbon Treaty, which will give legal status to the Charter of Fundamental Rights of the European Union, linking civil, political, social, and economic rights recognised in the Union. This has been an interesting process for Ireland, because we have a history of saying no every time we're asked by an institution we see as more powerful. So we said no the first time they presented the Lisbon Treaty to us, and with a certain amount of persuasion agreed to say yes on this occasion. In effect, the Lisbon Treaty, the Charter of Fundamental Rights, which will be written into the law of the European Union as a result of the treaty, builds a little bit on Article 6 of the original Treaty of the European Union, and also on the Treaty of Amsterdam, which outlaws discrimination. In this European context, there are very interesting discussions continuing, though, about the role of institutional religion In France, as you will know, secularism is considered to be of most importance. And in spite of media discourse to the contrary, the role of religion in education in the UK and indeed in Ireland is of particular significance. An interesting challenge to the European Union going forward, and an interesting challenge to the Member States after the Lisbon Treaty has been finally ratified, will be to find ways to encompass the various cultures and the very diverse ways of thinking about fundamental rights and about how they should be articulated and how they should be understood and how discrimination against them should actually be outlawed across the whole of the Union. In the field of discrimination, the legislation, the directives that were put in place forbidding discrimination on a variety of grounds in the workplace and forbidding discrimination on the basis of racism have been effective. But they have also led to continued discussion, which has become more heightened after what was referred to in Europe, and I'm sure here, as the Danish cartoons controversy. They've become more heightened then, and I suppose you could put them down to that struggle to balance freedom of expression with freedom from discrimination. That struggle to look to ways to prohibit incitement to hatred on one hand, while at the same time not enforcing people to love one another in a rather surface-like fashion. New European legislation around the framework decision on racism and hate crime will have the potential to walk just that tightrope. From these engagements and from these involvements, a number of things have struck me. Firstly, the gap between political discourse on one hand, which often brings with it a big defence of law and of policy and practice, versus the reality of people's lived experiences, to me seems to be widening. For many years, I've been actively involved in work with groups referred to in Europe as Roma, Sinti, and Travellers. Many countries have legislation, and indeed the European Union enforces legislation also, banning discrimination, including against Roma, Sinti, and Travellers. And yet the research that we've undertaken in the Fundamental Rights Agency demonstrates very clearly that there is a big gap between the discourse, the law, and what is referred to as implementation of the law on one hand, and the reality of people's lived experience on the other hand. The Fundamental Rights Agency of the European Union, which I chair, was established in 2007, and I have a whole series of notes about it that I'll make available to people, so I won't waste too much time saying too much about it. As an independent agency of the Union, with a board membership of one independent expert from each member state, a staff based in Vienna, and then contracted experts in each of the member states. What we're charged with is collecting reliable and comparable data and undertaking research in order to offer evidence-based advice to the Union and its institutions when implementing or considering community law in the field of fundamental rights. We're also charged with raising awareness throughout the Union with regard to fundamental rights. And lastly, we're charged with undertaking cooperation with civil society and other actors in that regard. We have no remit outside of the European Union, only for the 27 member states of the Union. And we have no capacity to engage in foreign policy on behalf of the Union. From our work there, though, and from my work with the OSCE, I've been very conscious also of the confusion between what I would call political ideology and religious ideology on one hand. And that sort of leading to increased designation of religious overtones to what might previously have been considered cultural matters. In other words, a slippery slope which makes certain things fashionable for as long as they line up with the political priorities of one state or another. And from that, the sort of hierarchies of oppression which emerge, which reflect the dominant political concerns of a particular time, have more of a capacity to change when the political concerns change than they have to change when resolutions to the real discrimination and persecution that underpins them is found. So that, for example, to look on the global stage in the latter half of the 20th century, for one period after the Second World War, persecution and discrimination against Jewish people was considered to be the priority. And if you look to the beginning of this century, in some parts of the West and Europe, discrimination and real discrimination against Muslim people is considered to be the priority. The reality that both forms of discrimination, and indeed very many other forms of discrimination and hate, continue unabated, is ignored. I have found also that discriminations need to be understood together, as well as targeted, if they are to be addressed. As a woman, I'm very conscious that if women in the second half of the 20th century, and perhaps not all of us women would have agreed with everything that was done on our behalves, but if women in the second half of the 20th century did not choose to actually name, as they saw it, the oppressions experienced by women, I don't think there'd be quite so many of us standing as I'm standing tonight. But at the same time, I'm equally conscious that although societies and discriminations are diverse, there are many things that link them together. Religious discrimination and religious intolerance and the right to practice one's religion freely can be linked with other discriminations and other intolerances. And I particularly note, with regard to religion, that those addressing those forms of intolerances, maybe because within the religions of which we are all part, there is a universe, that the capacity sometimes to look to others experiencing different but parallel forms of discrimination can be lacking. Diversity within religious movements and religions and within minorities experiencing discrimination also need to be understood. We're not all the same. Even those of us who belong to the same country and the same religion believe and experience differently. But we do share values. And defending the rights of people to practice their religion as they want to are defending rights for all. It's also been my experience that the most powerful are those who discriminate the most. And I have to say, when one looks to issues of addressing religious freedom, Indeed, when one looks to issues of addressing discrimination in many areas, the most powerful, inevitably, are the states and those who act on behalf of states. And I have to say as well, because I think sometimes it applies to all of us in our different roles, possibly those most blind to being possible discriminators are state agents, educators, officials, academics, and dare I say, even judges, even although an eminent one will speak after me, who are blind to the possibility that the acts, the actions, and the decisions that we undertake as we pursue our daily work could have the capacity to be discriminatory against others. Finally, having told you a little bit about my country and the European Union, having outlined some of the areas that I have seen to be important and I have struggled to address in my work, let me say to you by way of conclusion, what's very clear to me, as someone who came through that period in my own country when people like to pretend, and maybe in that part of Europe as well, when people like to pretend that religion was a thing of the past, perhaps something, a cultural phenomenon to be dealt with as part of a family structure. What's very clear to me as we move into this century is that the importance of religion cannot be underestimated. That it cannot be underestimated as providing a sense of value for people globally. It cannot be underestimated as providing a sense of comfort. And that the right to practice one religion is something which we still struggle to move from articulating as a right denied to being able to celebrate as a right that's claimed in its diversity throughout our world. Thank you.
I always get concerned when I'm asked to speak after such a distinguished person. I've been holding my breath, I'm still holding my breath, that I won't see you going out one by one. But before you do so, let me say this. Thank you for the invitation to come here. It's a great pleasure to be here. It's a great honor too. Perhaps what I enjoy most about conferences is their collegiality. They present a time to learn amongst equals, in the same way as I'm here to learn from you, and I will be learning through all the sessions that I'll be attending, and I'm sorry that I can't attend all of them. But for the moment, of course, I have you captive, and you shall have to listen to me. And so to begin the sharing, I wish to discuss the noisy land that is South Africa, the constitutional values that mediate the noise in my home, and how those values promote religious freedom. But first, let me tell you a story. The judges like to listen to stories. They listen to them all the time. So let me start with this one. About a year ago, an Italian singer and songwriter, his name eludes me now, was touring the United States for the first time. And during his tour, he was interviewed on National Public Radio. He had written a song called The Silence of America. The hostess of the show on which he was being interviewed asked him what the meaning of the song was. He said, "That is the thing that is most striking about this country. There is no noise, even in the noisy places." Now, just ponder that for a moment. Whether he was right or wrong is not for me to say, but it did cause me to pause and consider my home, South Africa. Tonight, I'll talk about South Africa because you can't be at home in the world at large unless you have a home of your own. Discussion between diverse peoples need not run for very long before it's immediately apparent that our provincial habits are of similar substance the world over. Thus is a provincial discussion decipherable and I trust meaningful to you all. So I tell my South African stories. We are a sociable species, and storytelling has long been a means by which to share our characters. Let me continue the story of noise. South Africa is a noisy country. I come from a noisy country. There is no silence, even in the silent places. That noise is the cacophony made by a young, vibrant society. Printing, broadcasting, shouting, litigating, shouting, asserting, challenging, defining, talking. The noise of those who wish to be heard, to be included. So we South Africans are always talking. I don't know if we're always listening as well, but we do talk a lot. So much so that in our 11 official languages, we have a wide nomenclature for the talking forums in our talkative nation. In Afrikaans, we call it a bosberaad. Loosely translated, it means a bush debate. In Zulu and Xhosa, it is an indaba, or the business of men. In Sesotho, it is a lekgotla, that is to have your say. I think it is rare to meet a South African who doesn't enjoy the sound of their own voice. We talked our way through apartheid to peace. We talked our way to constitutional democracy. And we continue to talk our way through our democratic project. So it is unsurprising that when a South African stands before you, as I do, he talks. We talk because talk was an effective means of opposition to the oppression of apartheid. That memory remains with us. We talk because we are a diverse society, literally. The world in one nation, and it is only consistent communication that prevents people from confining themselves within their own hives and ignoring one another in a heterogeneous society. That reality bonds us. We talk because we're a nation with a high social metabolism for what established democracies had centuries to resolve. We are intent in our predictably competitive fashion to achieve in a matter of hours. There is always something to say, something to contradict, someone to heckle, somebody to praise. I doubt that we shall be silent anytime soon. And I would mourn that day should it ever come to pass. But for speech to be heard, to be understood, and to be contributory, it must be in the language of your audience. Language compels us to perceive the world through the eyes of those who present it to us. Through their words, we sense their gravities and trivialities. Just as language defines them, however, so our reaction to that language portrays them, and it portrays us too. Accept a person's language, and you acquire their admiration. Speak it, and you shall begin the journey to earning their trust. In South Africa, that common language is our constitution. It is the patient conductor of the noisy country that is South Africa. Our constitution is simultaneously a bastion guarding civil and political rights, an intervener enforcing social and economic rights, and a mediator allowing robust civic engagement. But most importantly, our constitution is a teacher from whose collective memories of those who suffered under apartheid, that drafted it, from whom may come compassion, understanding, and tolerance. Tolerance is critical in a nation in flux, since it is a hallmark of open and democratic societies that they have the capacity to accommodate and manage difference in a reasonable and fair manner. Therefore, the object of the Constitution is to allow different concepts about the nature of human existence to inhabit the same public realm and to do so in a manner that, at worst, is not mutually destructive and at best is mutually supportive, enabling the state to function in a way that shows equal concern and respect for all. Through this, we hope to create a society that heals the divisions of our past and establishes a culture of democratic values, social justice, and fundamental human rights. That division of the past was apartheid. That butcher of dreams, predicated on creating separating and alienating constructed difference. And yet, through violence, what really characterized apartheid was the careful and rigorous construction of a logically regimented legal system that at every turn supported all acts committed in furthering the objectives of apartheid. During apartheid, no act, no matter how heinous, was performed in a legal vacuum. Law underwrote it all. It is remarkable then that as apartheid died and a new South Africa was born, it was the law that was chosen to reign supreme. Not an ideological icon or demagogue, nor a collective ideology, but law. The principle of the rule of law, however awfully it had been understood and applied under apartheid, was not only allowed to continue, but it retained its place at the core of the republic. And so the very defining feature of apartheid, its scrupulous adherence to law, became the most exalted aspect of the new South Africa, namely her life as a constitutional democracy. Law had not been alone in facilitating apartheid. Where the law cemented apartheid, so a particular brand of Christianity, whilst perhaps not providing a backing for it, certainly assisted in validating its existence. Though not theocracy, the various forms of the Africana Calvinist-inspired Dutch Reformed churches played an active role in cozily supporting the apartheid government. That is not to say that Christianity at large supported apartheid. Some churches were passive participants, neither for nor against apartheid, whilst a third group, composed principally of Protestant, Methodist, and Catholic churches, were angrily critical of apartheid, and they suffered accordingly. I should add of the Africana churches that today they have embraced rights-based democracy. Indeed, they were the first religious grouping to accept same-sex marriages following legislative amendments to that effect in South Africa. Despite the schism between the church groupings in South Africa, in their attitude towards apartheid, and the non-theocratic nature of the state, it was a distinctly Christian view of life that prevailed in law. Religious instructions in state schools was necessarily Christian. The Sunday Sabbath was strictly observed with regard to commerce, particularly alcohol. Christian oaths were administered in criminal trials, and it was only Christian marriage that bore recognition as a valid marriage alongside civil marriage. Other faiths, near needless to say, were marginalized, and we have many faiths in South Africa. We have Judaism, Hinduism, Islam, Buddhism, animism. This list is not closed. Our faiths in South Africa are as diverse, perhaps, as our faces. When the time came to draw a new constitution, a constitution that rejected apartheid, the clause guaranteeing freedom of religion was one of the most vigorously contested. It was clear that in a diverse democratic society, it would be most undesirable for the state to identify with a particular religious doctrine. And yet South Africa was and remains a profoundly religious and overwhelmingly Christian society, a society where religion could not be pushed to the social margins. The natural solution was to create an equitable order of balanced rights and obligations. Therefore, the special place of religion in our society was to be preserved. Indeed, the preamble to our constitution now concludes, "May God protect our people. God bless South Africa." Today, everyone in South Africa has the right to freedom of conscience, religion, thought, belief, and opinion. The expansive wording means that we are saved from the undesirable debate of what constitutes a religion. The right allows a person to entertain such religious beliefs as a person chooses, declare their religious beliefs openly and without fear of reprisal, and manifest that religious belief by worship, teaching, and dissemination. The right also allows a person to act together with others. It is frequently the communal shared meanings of a particular belief that give it value. Therefore, those convictions can neither be acted out in isolation nor held in the mind only. They must take place in fact and indeed in the presence of others who understand, validate, and share the experience. The corresponding obligation upon the state in respect of all rights is to respect, protect, promote, and fulfill the rights in the Bill of Rights in accordance with the values of equality, dignity, and human freedom which underlie South African society, taking into account the fact that we are a member of the community of nations, and so observe international and foreign law in addition to evolving our common law heritage. In the context of religion, this means at a minimum that the state may not coerce the adherents of a particular faith away from their beliefs. Optimally, the state must act fairly and equitably to all religions. This does not mean that the state must be equally ignorant of all religions. However, South Africa has no establishment clause. There is no strict separation between religion and the state. Rather, the state is entitled to support religious activities, provided that it does so equitably, meaning that equal consideration must be accorded to all. Therefore, the South African state, while neither religious itself nor pro-religion is certainly for religion, and by that I mean accommodating of and appreciative to religion. It is for religion because the Constitution is for human rights, one of which is the freedom to hold and express religious convictions alone, as well as in the company of others. It is one thing, however, for the state to acknowledge the important role that religion plays in our public life, and consequently to be accommodating of it. It is quite another to use religious doctrine for interpreting the Constitution. It would be out of order to employ the religious sentiments of distinct segments of a society as a guide to the constitutional rights of all. Between and within religious, they are vastly different and at times highly disputed views. Judges would be placed in an intolerable situation if they were called upon to construe religious texts and take sides on issues which have caused deep schisms between religious bodies. Judges would find themselves in the invidious position of determining which knowledge was the ultimate truth. In the open democratic society contemplated by the South African Constitution, there must be mutually respectful coexistence between the secular and the sacred. The function of the courts is to recognize the sphere which each inhabits, and not force the one into the sphere of the other, provided that there is no prejudice to the fundamental rights of any person or group, the law will legitimately recognize the diversity of strongly held opinions on matters of great public controversy. I would like, however, to leave you with this one thought. Apartheid was grounded on law. No single act of apartheid was committed outside of the law. Those who ruled over the country enacted laws and oppressed through the law. Consider that. Apartheid also relied on religion. The churches gave justification for the oppression through apartheid. What does that tell us? It tells us that the law can be an instrument for good. Since 1994, the law has been made to work for justice. But it also tells us that it is possible for people to manipulate religion to serve other purposes other than that which is good. And it is for us, the people, to see to it that both the law and religion serve good. I thank you.
We wish to thank our distinguished speakers. Thank you very much for your thoughts tonight. We'll ask you now to pass out of the room, going this way, go out of the room this way, or this way toward the reception that is in the lobby and beyond.